40,000, over 40,000 pound vehicle into orbit, called the ATV, Automated Transfer Vehicle. Actually, they give it a name. Each one has a name. This one's called Einstein, Albert Einstein. Drop it. Scientist. The last one, it was after an Italian scientist. But this one's the Albert Einstein one. Heaviest cargo ever. It's, now, like I mentioned before, the SLS, the Space Launch System for NASA will be 143 tons in 2017. This thing is around 48,000 pounds, so about 24 tons. So you're looking at a big difference between the two. SLS, to give you an idea, when that thing is launched, it's going to be six times more powerful than the European Space Agency's biggest rocket now, which is a little over 2 million pound thrust for the European Space Agency, Ariane 5. So, and the cargo that they bring up is the largest, for supplies. They bring up fuel for bringing the space station up higher. They bring in tons of food and water and oxygen. Drop a grand total of almost 6,000 pounds. Progress is about one third of that. Give you an idea. About 2,000 pounds, a little less. So it's going to be a shame to see this one go down. The only thing that we'll have left is the Dragon for resupplies. The H-2 by Japan, and of course the Progress by Russia. And probably in a few months, by the end of the year, you'll have the Antares Cygnus group by Orbital Science joining the fleet to man the space station by, bring up supplies. Out of all those that I've mentioned, the only one that will eventually be manned will be the Dragon spacecraft. Let me drop it. And also another one by Sierra Nevada called Dream Chaser, but that's quite a few years down the road. They're working on it. They have their prototype built. They've tested it with parachutes and all, but eventually that would be a manned craft as well. So there you have it, Dick. Back to that WS2N.
It does sound like an awful lot of our space launches are now going to be private companies, not National Aeronautics and Space Administrations. One other thing I wanted to bring you guys' attention, and that is, for decades now, we've been hearing about global warming and carbon dioxide greenhouse effect causing it. There is a study that has just come out that sounds very authoritative. Requires some further investigation, in my opinion. It's entitled Global Warming Caused by Chlorofluorocarbons, Not Carbon Dioxide, New Study Says. And this was sent to me by Ken, WA5EJB, and the good news is he gave me the whole darn article with all of the graphs that go with it. But the bad news is I haven't yet found the URL where you can get a copy of it. When I do find that, I'm going to send it over to Bernie's website. And I found a couple of URLs here that are very long. So I'm pretty sure if you Google the word global warming and chlorofluorocarbon, you'll get a copy of this. But what the article is saying, let me drop.
Look up the Montreal Agreement 1990, Dick.
Yeah, give me a couple words on that one, Paul. Are you saying the Montreal Agreement... Were they also saying that chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, are a much stronger causative agent to the global warming than is CO2? What this article is saying, and the graph is showing you, is that now that we've outlawed Freon 12, for instance, and therefore we're no longer putting it into refrigerators and air conditionings and cars and blasting from tremendous amount of it into the atmosphere ultimately, and it apparently has a tremendous destructive effect on the atmospheric ozone. And so now that we've outlawed it, and because of the cyclicity of the way chlorofluorocarbon acts on the peaks and valleys of the sunspot cycle, let me drop. This graph shows you the year-by-year amount of total global temperature measurements. You look at that alongside of a graph of the peaks and valleys on the 11-year solar cycle, and you'll see an extremely strong correlation. You look at the fact that we outlawed chlorofluorocarbons around the year 2000, and so no longer the amount that we're manufacturing and shipping into the atmosphere has very rapidly decreased starting at that time. And you look at the continuation of the global graph, and you plot it against CO2 increase, and you plot it against chlorofluorocarbon decrease and cyclicity, and the global warming temperatures follow the second, not the first. In other words, this professor is making a very strong case that global warming is only a secondary effect of CO2. It's a primary effect of chlorofluorocarbon destruction of the ozone layer, and that for us to try to become carbon neutral, his point, I think, is that for us to become carbon neutral or to control carbon emissions is going to be extremely difficult, but to control the CFCs is, by comparison, extremely easy. And it looks like if this graph is showing me the right thing between the year 2000 and 2013, that global warming has essentially stopped. Well, you compare that to these super storms that we get like Sandy, and you got conflicting information, if you know what I mean. But you got to be careful that we don't look at just local effects of something like Hurricane Sandy. Let me drop. You really got to look at total global thermal temperature. But this graph, as I said, I'm eventually going to find for you the exact URL. You look at it, and it makes an extremely strong case that we've been fighting the wrong war. That we are fighting the right war by getting rid of CFCs. And for us to fight to get rid of CO2s is going to make a huge economic impact, and maybe it's not worth the effort, is one possible conclusion. So maybe you know of a URL that already says this. Maybe you've already seen this evidence poll. So give us a few words on that. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I can just tell you, I've read it somewhere in the last year or so that it was declining because of possible chlorine, basically. It's a chlorine problem, but the CFCs, you know, once they get up into the atmosphere, it gets broken down into chlorine, and that becomes your big problem. And 1990 Montreal Accord was by most countries, not all. Well, they all got together, Montreal, and including Bush, the first Bush, and they'll signed off on this, essentially killing the refrigerant Freon 12, and eventually leading to 22. I mean, that's 22 is being phased out, you know, for your air conditioning, you know, for your residential air conditioning. That's kind of getting phased out. Came in the green tanks. The white tanks were always the Freon 12, and they're gone for the car, and they're now 134A. In fact, I have an old car, and years ago I switched over, had it retrofitted to 134A, because you can't even buy it. Let me drop it.
On a quick break, Paul, is Freon 22 considered equally as destructive as Freon 12? Do we delay the Freon 22 because it is less destructive? Over to you, Paul.
It's also in the halogen group, but I guess that 12, I think, had a... I'm going back 20 years, but I think it had a... You know, it had more of the destructive chlorine effect once it got into the atmosphere. It got broken up by the ultraviolet rays of the sun, and then they started doing the chemistry between the argon and the ozone and affecting the ozone. And they figured out it would take 100 years to correct this problem every time that the ozone was destroyed. But by cutting back, I read recently, maybe within the last year, that it has had an effect on the ozone hole over the South Pole. Don't know if that's true, though. They're eventually going to have a world without Freon 12. If you have any of it, you'd probably be a millionaire if somebody wanted it. But it's inexpensive. Let me drop it. Inexpensive to get your car switched over. They change the oil in your refrigerator in the air conditioner and in the car. Depending on the car, it's relatively inexpensive. I think mine was done for $60, 60, retrofit deck. And all they do is they put different adapters on your low side and your high side. You know, now your old connection from your Freon tanks. You know, if you had an old set of refrigerant gauges, they just won't fit. Now you need the new diameter size thread to fit these new adapters that you can put on, so you can get your Freon 134A in back there.
Yeah, the cars with the 134A are a little bit less efficient on air conditioning than the ones on the Freon 12. And for a long time, I had an old car using Freon 12, and there was a substitute material you could buy that was a mixture of various things that worked almost like Freon 12. And I do remember putting that into one of my cars, and it works fairly well. So there's a website that'll tell you an equivalent to Freon 12 for your older cars. All the newer cars, I think, are on the 134, which, yes, require a different kind of adapter for your gauge set if you do your own air conditioning repair, as I do. And part of the reason I bought the dual-stage vacuum pump is not only to do air conditioning repair, but you can vacuum out the water for air-filled Andrew Heliac's coaxial cable. And I even tried doing it one day. Let me drop.
You might have air in there, Dick. I mean, there's no difference. There's no difference.
Hold on now. Any water moisture you've got inside of a Andrew Heliac's cable, because you don't have good seals on the end, and on a hot day versus a cold day, the air inside is expanding and contracting. And of course, on a hot day, the rain comes along, rapidly cools the cable, and the water on the outside gets sucked into the cable. So getting water inside of air-filled cable is a real problem. And your two choices are to either periodically vacuum it out or to continuously supply positive pressure of dry nitrogen or dry desiccated air. You want to keep your air-filled cables, and air-filled cables are desirable because they're the lowest in loss. That's the good news. The bad news, you've got to do some extra things to keep the water out of them. So I'm not quite sure what you're saying now, Paul. Air inside of the cable is okay, but when you start adding water, particularly liquid cooled water, shorting the center conductor to the shield on your cable and sitting in there making copper oxide, that's going to give you grief. And one of my cables did get a small hole in it. Failure of the mast means that on a windy day, the mast was whipping back and forth, and the very strong 3/16 diameter elements on my 432 Yagis were ramming into the side of the tower and piercing the Andrew Heliac 7/8 inch cable. Rammed a nice hole in it, and water poured into the hole, and for that I don't have a good piece of cable. So air is okay. It's the moisture that comes with it, though, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Now we're in a time shift. I'm talking about the, you said the 134 was, you know, more of a strain, and then, you know, not as efficient as the R12, and I'm telling you, it's about the same BTUs per pound, you know, on evaporation, but which is very close. I mean, there's essentially no difference. So I said maybe you have air still left in your system, in your air conditioning system in the car, and to change that, of course, you would have to pull a make sure you pull a good strong vacuum before you put the 134 in. I'm guessing maybe you still had air left in your system. That would make it less efficient.
Now I see what you're saying, and you're absolutely right, Paul. A really smart guy doing air conditioning work, when he's about to tap into your system, he's got his manifold gauge set with his pieces of tubing coming out of it, and he's about to attach it to your low side or high side of your air conditioner in order to make a pressure measurement. And if the guy was not properly trained, and if he's quick and dirty, he just connects the cables. He's completely forgetting about the fact that that length of tubing, the length of rubber hose in between the gauge set and the connector that's about to tap into your system, it contains air. And you put air inside of an air conditioning system, and you're going to suffer. You really don't want to do that. So a smart guy will connect the long piece of rubber hose loosely to the point he's about to tap into it. Then with the right source of the Freon connected to the gauge set, he pours some Freon through that piece of hose in order to purge the air that's in that piece of hose. He purges the air first, so there's nothing in that piece of hose but the coolant, before actually making the full connection to the low side or the high side. A smart guy will do that. You look at a quick and dirty guy who doesn't really know how to, who wasn't properly trained, and he starts pumping a hose full of air into your system every time he taps into it. And pretty soon you've got a very low efficiency system. That's sort of what I think you're saying, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, 100% right, Dick. And then also, if you're changing out your Freons, if they don't pull that vacuum on there good enough, they're not going to get all the Freon 12 out of there to do it. I mean, nowadays you have to have reclaim bottle and all. You can't just vent the stuff into the atmosphere and then pull a vacuum on it. You're supposed to reclaim it. There's a paper trail on this all now. It's a different world than 20 years ago. But, yeah, 100% right, Dick. That's actually the biggest failure, leaving the air in the line between the manifold gauge and the Schrader valve. Back to you, Dick.
With your particular occupational experience, Paul, I wonder if you're one of these guys that's qualified to reclaim the Freon 12, and in some cases even reinstall Freon 12 that has been refurbished. I know that it requires some special licensing, and I wonder if you're one of those guys. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've got the universal license, and it's funny, it was, maybe half a dozen years afterwards, I got to the point where I retired, so I didn't get a chance to use it much, that's for sure. But yes, I do have the universal license. Go for a test for that. In fact, Bosey said years ago had a test. They would give the test, so you'd study for it, and you'd actually go down for the test. They gave them in different places. I took mine in Bosey, in the South Shore.
I'm going to take...
Go right ahead, John.
Well, don't forget, Dick, there was supposed to be two negative poles on the air conditioning system. You would evacuate, then you charge with nitrogen, then you evacuate that, and then charge with Freon, because nitrogen had a great affinity for moisture.
So I think you're saying that if you can't pull a really high vacuum, 97.9 or whatever it is, inches of mercury, if you don't have a dual stage pump on a warm day, I mean, if it's a cold day when you're doing this, you may not be able to boil out all the water. What you're trying to do is, for the temperature of the day that your air conditioning system is being subjected to, if you can create a vacuum considerably lower than the water vapor pressure for that particular temperature of day, as long as you can create that good a vacuum and considerably better, in theory, you boil off all the water that's in the system, it turns into water vapor and gets sucked out by the multi-stage vacuum pump. But to really get all the water out is extremely important. A couple of drops of water in an air conditioning system will immediately freeze at the end of the pitot tube, the expansion tube, and close off the flow of the Freon that's trying to do the cooling. And so it's a really nasty problem. I think you're saying that by cyclically putting in dry nitrogen, which has a higher affinity for the water vapor, you do a better job of vacuuming out the system and getting rid of the water vapor. And that's one of the major failures of an air conditioning system. Let me drop. If you develop a major leak somewhere where the system comes down to air, as I call it, and air gets into it, and the moisture in that air also gets in there, you're in a heap of trouble. And the average person, when he's starting to get a failure, runs the air conditioner anyhow without the proper flow of the Freon. The oil isn't being moved through the system correctly. Therefore, the compressor is not being properly oiled. Therefore, it's making metal chips. And the metal chips start piling up inside of all the nooks and crannies of your condenser coil. And getting rid of those is almost impossible. So it's a real step-by-step failure of the system if the person continues to operate it when it's got a leak. You probably have a bunch of opinions on all of this. So to really thoroughly vacuum it out, you have to pray that there's no metal chips in there. And I guess you're using the dry nitrogen multiple times. Is that the way it's done, Paul? John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, there's all different types of systems. You know, you get capillary system and expansion valves, but the expansion valves, as soon as any moisture hits that expansion valve and opens up, that expansion valve is usually gone. So, yeah, that was very important by the manufacturers on all the systems we had to do. We had to fill them with nitrogen and then evacuate that and then charge. But you could, if you pulled a clean enough vacuum for a long enough time, you probably get most of the water out. But with the nitrogen, you know, it's a positive thing. But that's just a recommendation from every manufacturer that we ever did for.
I'm guessing, John, you are maintaining some extremely large industrial-grade refrigeration and air conditioning systems, which I guess are part of the cooling systems for some of the machinery you worked on. Is that approximately what was going on there, John? Over to you, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, that's right. 400 horsepower, 600 horsepower. Most of those were chilled water. Some were brine. We also had the water tower systems, all of them. And each of them had their own, oh, Paul would know better than I, but each of them had their own little freaky things that you have to do. But some of the glycol systems, when they shut down, if they didn't shut down in the correct order, the glycol would solidify, and then, wow, what a project you had. But those were huge buildings and machineries that had to be kept cold. The brine systems, we found those in places like juice manufacturers and meat houses. For some reason, they like those. A couple of ammonia systems, but most of them are basic Freon.
So I think these cooling systems that you're describing were used for food preparation, food preservation, and in some cases, a total cooling of a very large multi-story building. Is that where these systems were being applied, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yeah, Dick. Some of these had 12-inch pipes with water in them, and that was circulated through the building. But there were also freezers, like down in Florida. They have what looks like a tank field for an oil company, and that's all full of orange juice. And you go in there, some of them are 20 below zero, 30 below zero, and big systems. But, yeah, that's a hairy thing to work on.
Dick, I just want to ask John something.
Go ahead.
Well, they could, you're calling them blind systems. Weren't they, what you're really describing are absorption systems, correct?
Yeah, the glycols were absorption systems, that's correct.
Okay, yeah, I thought so, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nothing to do with any kind of compressors or anything, just actually running off the heat. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, and Paul, it's a funny thing. It took more BTUs to cool the building than it did to heat the building because we had to run two boilers for the glycol system. In the wintertime, we only ran one boiler that heated the entire structure.
Yeah, you had your glycol running up and down for the towers to cool, and then you had heat exchangers going to your absorption machines, which has the brine in it. It goes on and on. But, you don't want those things to shut down prematurely and salt up. I think that's the problem you were discussing, right, John?
You got it. I don't know why they solidified, whether they salted up or just congealed. But when that happened, that was a couple of days' work, Paul. Well, I'm sure you know.
I personally didn't get involved with it, but I know the end results, and you spend days heating pipes up with torches and everything and trying to get the system going again. Okay, very good, John. It's complicated. That's probably one of the earlier air conditioning systems is the absorption system, but probably one of the most complicated to understand. Back to you, Dick.
I have two sets of questions for you, Paul. One, why in the world would you be cooling orange juice to 20 below zero? Is that to freeze it into the solid state in order to ship the orange juice concentrate in frozen form? Why would you keep orange juice that cold? Over to you, John.
Yeah, they keep it minus 20 to minus 40 for preservation and flavor protection. That's what I was told. I took a grand tour of that plant when we were down there, and they showed us every aspect of it. And nothing goes to waste in the orange. Even the orange peels are used in mixed cattle feed. They use everything in the orange. It's unbelievable, sort of like a pig.
I'm guessing orange juice at minus 20 to minus 40 is in the solid form. Now, water, when it goes to the solid form, it expands, and it'll burst pipes. And I don't think orange juice stays in the liquid form at minus 20 to minus 40. It sounds like it would be very difficult to deal with a tank full of it at that temperature if you want to draw some of it out of the tank. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, they have tanks I know that were very cold. They had a lot of ice around them, and that was a slushy, sort of like a Slurpee. I don't know if it freezes to a solid like water freezes. I know it freezes to a crystal, but I believe there's a lot of motion available because of the space between the crystals. You can crunch it up.
I was reading an interesting article, because water still fascinates me, the water molecule. And water, when it's formed into ice, each individual crystal of the ice is a tetrahedron. In other words, a four-sided regular figure. If you made four equal angular triangles and you put them together just right, you make this pyramid-shaped object called a tetrahedron. And the oxygen molecule sits in the middle of that tetrahedron. The two hydrogen molecules, atoms I should say, are connected to two of the apexes, and they're connected electrostatically by way of that oxygen atom in the center. The other two remaining apexes of the tetrahedron contain an electron that goes in that direction. So that gives you some idea of why the water molecule is polarized. It's got two electrons sticking out on two of its apexes and two hydrogen atoms sticking out on the other two and the oxygen molecule dead center. And by the way, calculating the angles of all of this, now that gives me a little bit more understanding of why the two hydrogen molecules are offset by some crazy number, like 109 degrees, because that's the angles going to the apexes of a tetrahedron with the oxygen atom in the center. And eventually I think I'm going to understand why in the world all of this changes, that when you go lower than 4 degrees Kelvin, or 4 degrees centigrade, or higher than 4 degrees centigrade, in either direction, water expands. The expanding of water in the form of ice, which is a very rare phenomenon, creates a whole lot of life on the planet, because ice floats on the surface of water, and the fish and the other animals can continue to swim on the...
Repeater, time out.
The ice forms a nice barrier at the top. The ice expanding makes it float. The rest of the stream or the lake or whatever stays liquid down below. The animals continue to swim around down there. And the whole darn thing doesn't freeze from top to bottom. If ice formed the other way around, if ice was a contracting material, it would form at the bottom of the spring or bottom of the lake, the whole lake would freeze solid. It would be killing off those animals and creating a lot more grief. So this crazy property of water, I think I'm eventually going to understand it. I now understand, I think, how water going from the liquid state to the gaseous state, to the vapor state, why it creates such a huge amount of cooling, and why in the opposite direction, when water goes from the vapor state back to the liquid state, you get a tremendous amount of heating, which is the engine that fires your hurricanes and tornadoes. But this expansion phenomena of water is still a bit of a mystery to me. I wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice has got a better explanation for why ice expands as it freezes. K2RIW listening.
Those guys in Canada should know a lot about ice, right, Dick?
Yeah, anytime they find a piece of ice, the next thing they do is put on their skates and start doing some hockey. Scott, can you explain why ice expands as it freezes? B3ZTZ, hitting you cold on this one. There's a pun there somewhere. K2RIW in the tech net. Maybe Scott got disconnected. So we'll eventually understand that one. Now, I know that Wes wanted to discuss the Maury Radiant Energy System. And I know that it's somewhat connected. This latest YouTube video that Wes wanted us to look at is over an hour long. And it's a professor explaining these resonances you get between Earth and what I'm going to call the ionosphere. And I know that Tesla believed that that was going to be the mechanism by which he could experience a lot of power extraction from the Earth, as well as an ability to transmit power wirelessly from the power station to the individual customers by way of this resonance phenomena that you get between Earth and the ionosphere. So I think that's what Wes wanted to discuss.
Question before, Dick?
Yeah, go right ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I meant to ask you before when you were discussing it. On the Voyager spacecraft, I remember Paul saying that the power generator was losing approximately 4 watts per year, I think. Now, I've never worked with TWTs. How much more effort and money do you think, was it prohibitive to put an extra TWT on that so they could switch over after, say, 30 years? I mean, they knew it was going to deteriorate. You would think they would have tried to do that. Maybe you know a reason why they wouldn't. Back to you, Dick.
I'm not sure whether or not there is or is not a cold standby traveling wave tube alternate transmitter on Voyager. That I don't know. And the way a traveling wave tube usually comes to end of life, and we amateurs who are microwave enthusiasts have collected a large number of traveling wave tubes. The ones that we get our hands on that somebody has discarded usually are one of three modes of failure. The power supply, the high voltage power supply running at something like 10,000 volts, there's all kinds of ways it can arc over, get contamination, get the black streaks across the printed circuit board where you get the, you know, extra conducting paths that shouldn't be there. There's lots and lots of ways the high voltage power supply can fail. Well, in the vacuum of space, where you don't have any moisture, that's not too much of a problem. If you've done a good design on the power supply, it's going to hang in there. Let me drop.
Dick, they have a traveling wave tube on Voyager.
Yeah, I know they've got one, and that's the main thing that's doing the transmitting, because in 1976, when that thing was launched, and the design probably started in 1970, in 1970, you didn't have 10-watt transistors of any kind that operated with reliability at 8.5 gigahertz. They had no choice but to use a traveling wave tube. That was the best high-power amplifying device in the world at that time. And so one of the questions John is asking is, yes, it's the traveling wave tubes that we're listening to right now. Is there a standby second tube in case the first one fails? I don't think they had the volume, the weight, the dollars, and whatever, and all the switching hardware to put in a second standby traveling wave tube. But maybe they did. Let me pass it over to you for that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, standby. No. Just like I said last week, I mean, it was the 70s when they designed it, early 70s, And I mean, they even have an 8-track tape, but no standby. I think we started off as a 25-watt traveling wave tube, and you got to remember, everything was redundancy back then for all the different missions, going to the moon, or your orbiting missions, the Pioneer, they had two missions go out, they had two voyages go out in case one failed. I mean, that was the mindset. And they never would have thought it was, these things would be going 35 years into the future. They were looking at, you know, their main concern was investigating Jupiter, going, you know, doing the flyby, Saturn, and then they were hoping that they would get to see Uranus and Neptune, and they did, and they actually canceled one program. Both were supposed to do that, but Voyager 1, they said, let's get a look at the moon of Titan around Saturn, so that thing threw it off the ecliptic, and that's why it's going up 45 degrees. So yeah, I mean, they never figured on it. I'm sure if they did, they'd have a backup to backup to keep these things running. Back to you.
Yeah, when you spend roughly $1 billion making a spacecraft like that, and you go through all the rigmarole of launching it, calculating exactly what velocity, what direction, are you steering it correctly, is it navigating correctly, are the cameras working? There's a zillion things that have to work right. However, if that radio link between that $1 billion spacecraft and you, if that radio link is lost, you're off the air. You're dead in the water. Everything else can be gold-plated and perfect. Without that radio link, you got nothing. So these remotely powered, remotely piloted, I'm going to call it, unmanned spacecraft, that radio link is extremely important. In the case of the radio, in the case of the manned spacecraft, like Apollo, if they lost that radio link between the Apollo spacecraft and Earth, it's essentially game over. Their chances of survival are very slim, because all of the real brain power to figure out what to do next in any one of their modes of failure came from the smart guys in the back room down on Earth saying, you better use this piece of paper, you better take that piece of duct tape, let me drop it. You take that piece of duct tape, you take that piece of cover on your manual, and you use that particular square filter, you make this round adapter so that the air filters that are in the loader module can be used on the command module, and so on. I mean, a lot of that adaptations and survival practices came from the guys in the back room on Earth calculating what to do next and sending up that information on a radio beam. You lose that radio beam on Apollo on the way to the moon. You take the most powerful telescope we had at the time, Palomar, and you aim it at the command service module. You'll see a white dot against the black sky saying, yes, I'm seeing the reflected sunlight off that spacecraft. And if the astronaut is now putting an emergency message that he writes on a piece of paper and holds it up to the window, and you think you're going to read that message, forget it. You can barely see their approximate location. That's all you've got. You couldn't tell whether or not they aimed up, down, left, or right. You couldn't tell what they're trying to say. You can't wave a flag, if you know what I mean. Without that radio beam, you got nothing. So it was extremely important. And so, as I was starting to say, in the case of the Voyager spacecraft out there at 8 billion miles or whatever it is, let me drop it. That radio beam really got to work. That traveling wave tube, it's got to fly. So it's got a very, very reliable high voltage power supply. That's one of the modes of failure that we amateurs buy used TWTs, high voltage power supply failures. And there's about 3 or 4 different ways that they fail, and they're all repairable most of the time. The next mode of failure is the defocusing of the beam. Most of the traveling wave tubes that we can get our hands on have periodic permanent magnets. In other words, there's a whole bunch of samarium cobalt or neodymium magnets in toroidal form around the actual linear tube of the traveling wave tube. You got a whole bunch of these magnets, north, south, and you got about 50 of them stacked together. And they're all exactly the right magnitude and location so that beam going down the center stays focused. You want that beam of electrons going down the center of the tube to stay within, let me pick a number, a 16th of an inch diameter going down the center of the tube, not touching the helix. If they touch the helix, these high-speed electrons at near speed of light strike the helix, create local heating, burn it out, and you're off the air. So you don't want your beam to touch the helix. And your power supply, one of the main functions of the power supply is to measure helix intercept current. And if it exceeds 10 or 15 microamps, the power supply goes into the self-protect mode and it turns itself off. So we amateurs, when we get a hold of one of those tubes, the first thing you got to do is very quickly turn it on, measure the amount of helix intercept current, take your little bit of refrigerator magnet, hold it on the outside of the tube in just the right position in order to lower, in other words, to do a better job of focusing the tube. And once you find the right place to put your little piece of refrigerator magnet and you glue them all down, now you've got the tube refocused. The only other motor failure is that they didn't do a real good job of cleaning out the vacuum inside the tube, and the gettering function is not working correctly. You might have gas inside the tube, in which case there's not too much recovery on that other than the so-called wake-up procedure. The wake-up procedure consists of running nothing but the filament for a couple of days, hoping you heat up everything that's flying around in there that shouldn't be there, and therefore the gettering material will have a chance to act like flypaper and capture all of the ions floating around that are capable of arcing over your tube. The next motor failure you've got to worry about is they didn't do a real good job of designing the cathode so that it becomes contaminated. There's all kinds of fancy chemistry in that cathode that's supposed to boil up at just the right rate to keep the surface clean. And so you want the surface of the cathode with its coating material to stay clean so it does just the right amount of emitting. The cathode on the traveling wave tube is a concave-shaped object, and you want each of the portions of that concave shape to emit just the right amount of electrons so that they got the right trajectory so that when they go through that first anode, they all become focused into a tiny little beam going down the center of the tube. And so if the left side of that cathode emits more energy than the right side, the beam becomes unbalanced, becomes defocused. And so again, by the wake-up procedure, you might be able to recover that. So they've done an extremely good job of making an extremely pure cathode, very well-focused tube. They made sure they've got periodic permanent magnets in there that were already at the end of life of degaussing, if you know what I mean. After you've magnetized your magnets, they are going to slowly settle down to a slightly lower magnetic field. Let me drop. So they had, in the process of building and assembling that tube, they took thoroughly aged magnets that were no longer going to settle down to any lower amount of magnetic field, which will defocus. So they did a very good job of making a very pure cathode, making a very high vacuum tube with very few foreign materials in there. All of the materials inside the tube were completely purified to make sure they're not outgassing. Good magnets, good power supply, and here we are 35 years later, and that tube is still cranking. And it's probably still putting out a good percentage of the original power, obvious by the fact we're still talking to that darn thing. So with no standby special tube, that particular traveling wave tube that's in that spacecraft, if somebody put a price on it, and if they told me it cost them $150,000 in 1975 dollars to make it, I would believe it. I have seen traveling wave tubes that are slightly more exotic for a high-power microwave electronic countermeasures transmitter. I have seen tubes made by the Northrop Company that in 1985 dollars was selling for numbers like $120,000 for one traveling wave tube. Vacuum tubes are still here, and they're going to be here for some time to come. When it comes to klystrons and traveling wave tubes, can you imagine trying to build out of solid state a amplifying device that substitutes for a traveling wave tube? Let me drop. I can buy today a high-power traveling wave tube that is essentially flat from probably 8 gigs to 18 gigs. It can put out 500 watts of power and has 35 decibels of gain, and it can tolerate a dead short circuit. Can you imagine trying to make solid state to do that. 500 watts of power, an octave of frequency, tolerate a short circuit, and 35 dB of gain. You try to build a solid state equivalent of that. Wow. You can barely get to those kind of power levels over very narrow frequency regions. To cover an octave, no way. 35 dB of gain, you're going to have a zillion stages of 8 dB of gain each to do it. A great big set of hybrid dividers and combiners is a great big Christmas tree to take your drive power, separate it into all of the individual amplifiers, amplify it, and then bring it all the way back together again. You're going to be building a power supply that's issuing 1,000 amperes at 10 volts, and that in itself is a very difficult design, to make very high current with very well regulation at low voltages requires farads of capacitance to do it. Let me drop. Whereas building a 10,000 volt power supply at a couple of hundred milliamps, by comparison, that's easy. It only requires a few microfarads, if you know what I mean. So a solid state equivalent for traveling wave tube high power replacement, oh boy. The words roll off the tongue real easily. I've seen a number of these proposals where some naive person said, I don't like having a traveling wave tube here. That's vacuum technology. That's 1980s. And this is the 21st century. Why don't we make a solid state equivalent? You better go slow with that decision. You're about to find yourself into a very big minefield. Anybody got any further comments on this before we leave the subject? K2RAW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, and when you design it, Dick, it's going to have to fit into a spacecraft. There's a lot of limitations. You're right.
And that solid state equivalent, you do something wrong when you arc over the waveguide or whatever, so it sees the wrong impedance for a few milliseconds. If you don't have a very fast-acting, very well-designed protection circuit, you have just killed it. It is dead. You've got a dead short circuit between the source and the drain of a good number of those FET transistors that are doing all that work. You can kill it real fast. The traveling wave tube, for short periods of time, I have personally seen people put a traveling wave tube running at the multi-hundred watt level into a dead short circuit, and the thing sat there and laughed at you and kept right on working. You try to do that solid state, forget it. And to get 35 dB of gain out of a traveling wave tube, it's easy. To get 35 dB of gain at that power level, at that frequency, across that frequency region, with solid state, forget it. You got to work real hard. So, vacuum tubes, we may be, a progressive person will say vacuum tubes are old hat. They're going to be around for a long time to come, from my point of view. When it comes to the things that we...
Repeater, time out.
When it comes to the things that we amateurs can put our hands on, by which we put out significant amounts of real microwave energy at 10 and 22 and 40 gigs and doing moon bounce, tubes are it. You can dream about doing that solid state. And it's going to be a long time before solid state's going to catch up with that, in my opinion. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this before we leave it? K2LIW in the Tech Man.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
One of these days we've got to do some kind of a tutorial on traveling wave tubes, how it actually gains power, gains wattage. Now I'm looking at these pictures, you know, and you have the coax in, coax out, you've got the heater, the glass tube, the helix going around it, and the electron beam, but you know, nothing here says how. Now, you got RF in, RF out. Nothing says how in the world, if you're putting in a couple of watts on one side, why are you getting 100 watts out on the other side just because you're running an electron beam down the middle? Got to do... my guess is a lot of people don't understand this, Dick. Back to you.
You're only putting a couple of milliwatts on the input end and getting tens or hundreds of watts out of the output end. 30 and 40 decibels of gain. It only takes... Rarely does a high-power traveling wave tube require more than about 10 milliwatts of input to do its thing. Rarely, as I said. There's a kind of a fancy pulse-up tube that runs at higher power input, but that's a very special application. It uses an entirely different phenomenon for gain. I'll give you a couple of words on it now, Paul. In the case of a transistor or tube ordinary amplifier, It is what I call a bulk modulator. In other words, your cathode of a triode tube, for instance, is capable of emitting a whole lot of electrons if the control grid has, let's say, a positive voltage. You put a positive voltage on the control grid, it sucks some of those electrons off that cathode that's hot. Those electrons get into the vicinity of the control grid. They get sucked in there because it's got a more positive voltage. And at that time, they see this great big plate a little bit further on. It's got hundreds or thousands of volts on it. And it says, I'm going to go there. And so they do. And you put a big enough negative voltage on that control grid, the electrons never leave the cathode in the first place. Well, the few that do see the negative voltage on the control grid and get pushed back to the cathode again. They bounce back, if you know what I mean. So I call that a bulk modulator. You're modulating the number of electrons that leave the cathode and hit the plate. And therefore the plate current goes up and down as you make the voltage on the control grid go down and up. Let me drop. So that's a bulk modulator. A traveling wave tube is a velocity modulator. You've got this carefully controlled electron gun, not too different from the gun in the cathode ray tube, emitting a stream of electrons. The stream of electrons, by way of electrostatic focusing and magnetic focusing, becomes a thin 16th of an inch diameter stream of electrons running down the center of the tube, and they're going to hit the collector at the far end. So you got these electrons running down the tube, and you got 10,000 volts between cathode and anode, and you've got, it's actually cathode and helix. The helix is the main accelerator, believe it or not. Once you accelerate those electrons between the cathode and the helix, they're moving at a good fraction of the speed of light. After that, they stay focused and go down to the collector at the far end. Let me drop. So you may set up the tube so it's got a steady state current of, let me pick a number, 100 milliamperes and 10,000 volts. And I guess that would be around a 1,000-watt capable tube, 1,000 watts of dissipation going on in that beam. Okay. The helix is wrapped around the length of the tube. It's literally a helix. It's a helix piece of wire. It's an ordinary piece of wire, sometimes made out of tungsten, something that can tolerate high temperatures. And the helix has a certain diameter in the way it's wound, and it's got an outer metallic sheath. And the diameter and the outer sheath makes a kind of a coax cable that just happens to have a surge impedance of 50 ohms. So your helix acts like a 50 ohm transmission line, but the center conductor is helical as opposed to a straight piece of wire. Okay, so you got this 50 ohm signal that you've injected into the input end flowing down that helix. You've adjusted it in such a way that the helix is a slow wave structure. In other words, the electrons running down the helix, they may be running on the wire close to the speed of light, but because the wire has a certain tilt to it, just like the threads on a screw, it's really flowing in the longitudinal direction at, let me pick a number, one-third the speed of light. Let me drop. So the electrons flowing down the helix in the axial mode are moving at one-third the speed of light. On the piece of wire, they're really moving at the speed of light, but because of the slope of the wire, each individual turn, like the threads on a screw, they're moving at one-third the speed of light. And if you adjust the voltages in the tube such that the beam of electrons flowing down the center are also moving at one-third of the speed of light, they're almost synchronized, you've now got some beautiful things you can do. If you set it up in such a way that each individual turn of the helix is in the vicinity of one wavelength at your operating frequency, in that vicinity, you've now got a whole bunch of individual waves as far as each individual turn of the helix is concerned, flowing down the helix, and you've got the electron beam almost synchronized in it, into it, flowing down the center of the helix. Let me drop. Now, let's dynamically look at, take a snapshot and take a look at what's going on with that beam, with that RF wave flowing down the helix. At one instant of time, one turn of the helix is a little bit more positive than the turn to the left of it or to the right of it, a little bit more positive. That positive voltage on that turn of the helix is going to have a slight influence on the electron beam flowing down the center, and it's going to accelerate them. And the one turn further down, the the voltage on the helix is a little bit more negative than positive, and it's going to slow down the electrons that are in that vicinity. The voltage on the helix is influencing in a minor way the velocity of the electrons of the beam flowing down the center of the helix. When you do it just right, some of the electrons are being speeded up, some of them being slowed down, and the net result is they end up in bunches. They used to be a nice steady state stream. Let me drop. And that steady state stream is now being formed into bunches. Not too different from what's going on in the Large Hadron Collider. You're making your particles you accelerate there form into bunches by a fairly similar process. Now once you've got the bunching rate on the helix synchronized just right with the electron beam, down at the far end, your electrons that at the input end near the cathode were very close to a uniform stream of electrons. At the far end, they're now individual bundles. As the individual bundles of electrons, which by definition have a very large electric negative charge on them, as they sweep by the final few turns of the helix, you now get the opposite effect. The bunched electrons, with their negative charge, sweeping by those particular turns of the helix, excite a great big voltage in that helix by something similar to Faraday's law. So the bunching of the electrons at the far end means that the signal built up on the helix at the far end can have tens or hundreds of watts, even though the signal you put in at the input end only had milliwatts. It's about half of the story. I wonder if it makes some sense, Paul. The real klystrons and TWTs, the real main function of operation is velocity modulation creating bundles of electrons. WS2N, K2RIW in the tech net.
Somebody sat up all night thinking of this. Wow, back in who knows what year was this device? Wow, yeah, I see it. I see the, as you're talking, I'm looking at the diagram, so I see the helix, and the helix is being modulated at the beginning part of it. It's going to change the electron speed, or it's going to modulate the electron speed, and that toward the end of the tube is going to create an induction effect on the tail end of the helix, and it's gonna give a lot of amperage or power to the tail end of the coil, and then that's where you get your coax output. Very good, Dick. Very well done. But somebody really sat up thinking about this. Who dropped this up? What year was this?
I think it was a guy named Mr. Pierce. He did it in roughly 1942 or so, around that time frame. And I believe he was working at the Sperry Gyroscope Company at the time. And the Sperry brothers eventually went and left the company and formed Varian. I think the Varian Tube Company in California. I believe it was an East Coast invention that eventually became a very powerful West Coast company, because the management didn't understand the brain power that they had. It's another one of these typical situations where the equivalent of the human resources department had these guys that were acting kind of arrogant because they knew what they're doing, and the people around them, the management, couldn't tolerate the arrogance, and they built up a very strong psychological problem between the two. They ended up quitting the company and forming their own company and making a fortune. So Mr. Pierce was the original inventor of the idea in the early 1940s. Let me drop. And if you Google the word traveling wave tube and Pierce, you'll find out his original book and his original ideas on it. The traveling wave tube is a kind of additional technique compared to a klystron. The klystron came first, and the traveling wave tube came second. And the traveling wave tube has got tremendous bandwidth compared to a klystron. Klystron has got a bunch of cavities, microwave cavities, in the beginning of the beam that velocity modulate the beam, and a bunch of cavities at the end. But to try to make a slow wave structure out of cavities is a much more narrow band technique compared to this helix thing. But let me show you another problem you've got here. No matter what you do at the tail end of that helix, no matter how well you impedance match the tail end of it into your load on the outside of the tube,